Welcome to the MedTech Talent Lab, the number one catalyst for advancing careers and building high-performance teams. Sponsored by the Anthony Michael Group, helping companies secure in-demand talent in regulatory affairs, quality, clinical, engineering, R&D, and other areas for medical device, digital health, diagnostics, and other organizations across the U.S. life sciences sector. Here's your host, Mitch Robbins.
All right, welcome back to another episode here on the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. I'm your host, Mitch Robbins, the founder and managing director here at the Anthony Michael Group, building companies and careers across the U.S. MedTech industry and, of course, the greater life sciences. And I'm joined today by Mr. Jason Kroep, who is the Chief Technology Officer at Stratos Labs. Jason comes to the show today with over 25 years of experience in MedTech. At the front end of his career, he held positions in both product and electrical engineering and began to work his way into various executive leadership roles, overseeing R&D, engineering, and eventually becoming a CTO. He's worked for companies like Vero Biotech, CardioMEMS, and Cybersonics, to name a few. Jason has simultaneously been a panel reviewer for the National Science Foundation, reviewing both Phase 1 and 2 SBIR and STTR grant applications. As far as formal education, Jason holds his Bachelor's of Science degree in Biomedical Engineering and his Master's of Science in Electrical Engineering. And since 2018, he has been the CTO at Stratos Labs. Now, for those unfamiliar with the organization, Stratos is home to the world's only FDA-cleared device called the RES biosensor, which is clinically validated to capture lung sounds, including coughing, wheezing, ronchi, and other breathing sounds over time without requiring episodic patient intervention. Now, this leads to a stronger understanding of treatment response and earlier insight into exacerbations to prevent unnecessary hospitalizations, especially for people suffering from chronic respiratory diseases such as COPD and asthma. Without further ado, Jason, I'm so glad you're here, man. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm excited to dig into this. And like so many of the other episodes, we're going to really focus on how you got to where you are today. And because I think that there's so many insights that we can grab onto along the way and hopefully help others be able to follow in similar successful footsteps. But like many of the other episodes, I think to be able to get to where we are today, we got to go first back in time. So I'd love to know from you about your early years. Where'd you grow up? What was family life like?
Well, I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania. That's right on the lake on the northwestern side of Pennsylvania. Went to elementary school and middle school and high school there, and then eventually went to Boston for college.
Okay. Are you one of a couple siblings? Are you an only child?
Oh, I have two brothers, and
Where do you fall in the pecking order?
I'm the oldest.
Okay. That's funny. So there's three boys, and I'm the oldest as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's awesome. So growing up, most of your time obviously was spent in the Erie, Pennsylvania area. What held your interests outside of class? What were you into?
Well, all kinds of things. And, you know, and one of the things that I think, really helped me throughout my career was I like to try new things. I like to do a lot of different things and sometimes, too many things at the one time. But what was great is, you end up finding out, the things that you're good at and the things that you're bad at. And you kind of start getting a better understanding of who you are and where your interests lie. So I was interested in music. I was interested in sports. I was interested in a lot of different things, computers. And so I wasn't all that good at music. I wasn't all that good in sports, but, computers, electronics, and kind of doing some of those kinds of things, that's where it started, showing, hey, this is kind of where my interest lies. This is where, I'm a little bit better than, some of these other particular areas. So, I like to try a lot of different things and participate in a lot of different kinds of activities. And I think that helped me kind of narrow in very early, what areas that I was going to be interested in the future.
That's awesome. And as you're telling your story, I'm thinking about my two boys. So my oldest is going to be 9 in July, on July 4th, and my youngest turned 7 in March. And it's funny watching them because it's drastically different. The one is very heavily into technology and really super smart as far as the latest and things. He's teaching me things. I'm like, what is going on here? I'm feeling old, you know? And the other one is very into sports and he wants to be outside all the time and away from technology. They're both into music, which proud to say comes from me. But yeah, it is kind of funny how as a kid, you start to gravitate towards things. And that brings me to my next question for you. When you got to college, at that point, did you already know that, hey, I'm kind of more into this tech, I'm into computers, I'm into this type of engineering path? Did you already know that by the time you got to college?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was kind of interested in healthcare, but I was also interested in engineering and computer science. And so that's the reason why I chose biomedical engineering as a degree. And so, you know, I was thinking, hey, maybe I could go to medical school and become a doctor. So, the program that I joined in was a pre-med program for biomedical engineering. And so that also gave me the opportunity to see, you know, what are the particular areas. And I found that I was much better at, you know, physics, the math, the hardcore computer programming, engineering, those kinds of areas than I was at, you know, things like organic chemistry and, you know, some of the other things that, doctors are typically very good at. And so that gave me the opportunity to say, okay, medical school is probably not the area for me, but you know, it's engineering is where, you know, my interest lies.
Interesting. And so once you knew that piece and you came out of school, were you a product engineer right from the get-go to when you came out of school?
Actually not. You know, it's kind of interesting. So one of the things that really, you know, captured my interest and kind of drove my career, and it's amazing because it's exactly what I'm doing right now, this minute, is when I did my senior project. My senior project, and this was back in 1993, so it was a long time ago, was actually a wearable device, a wearable medical electronic device. It was a device that had a light sensor built into eyeglasses that collected light information for circadian rhythm research. And not only that, my advisor was the head professor for artificial intelligence. So, you know, all of that kind of comes together into exactly where my career went. But that is really what drove me, was that final project and just being able to, you know, develop and, you know, bring to testing, you know, a brand new, you know, device that could be used for medical research and medical development.
Talk about full circle.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That really is. You know, a fair amount of folks that listen to the show listen for motivation, and they've got, you know, these large aspirations of where they're taking their career. And it's folks like you that can kind of help pave their path and kind of learn from maybe some of the trips and falls that you've had along the way and make their life, you know, their road a little bit easier. When you look over the course of your career, of all the different roles that you've had and the responsibilities that you've had along the way, what do you call out as some of the pivotal roles or the pivotal responsibilities that you think really helped you become an executive and take on higher levels of responsibility?
Yeah, and again, it was a series of things. It wasn't just one thing. You know, it's a series of things. Now, coming right out of school back in 1993, the job market wasn't all that good. You know, and so I did look for...
what do you know? Here we are in 2024.
Full circle, right?
Yeah.
The job market wasn't all that great. And, you know, folks weren't really looking for fresh out engineers. I mean, it was very, very challenging for fresh out engineers. So the first position that I took was actually teaching electronics at a technical school. And I think that that was an extremely pivotal point because, you know, when you're trying to teach something, you're trying to explain something to somebody else, that's when you really in-depthly start to understand it. And you have a really good feeling of, you know, how other people think of the technology and how the technology can be used for useful purposes, right? Because all through school, you learn about theory, you learn about the mathematics behind it, but you don't really get into a whole lot of the hardcore use of the device, a hardcore, you know, what it at high level, what is this going to do for me? You know, and then when I had to teach this to somebody, I had to think about all those kinds of things. I had to think about it at many different levels. And then also, as you're trying to teach something to somebody else, you also have to make sure that you, you know, level it and simplify it to a point where you can get your point across as efficiently as possible. Otherwise, you know, especially with technology, you're going to lose somebody right away. Eyes will start glazing over once you start using acronyms. And, you know, one of the things that really helped me as a leader is, you know, having that experience teaching in order to better understand how to present to other people such that they can easily and quickly understand what you're trying to say, especially, you know, when you're talking about technology.
You know, that's such a great point. And I was having this conversation in my day job, which is recruiting. And we were talking with somebody who has been I was doing a reference, and we were talking about someone who's been a mid-level manager who was about to take the next step up. And one of the pieces of feedback was this person is such an expert, but they have a hard time sometimes taking all the expertise and contracting it to give the enough substance for an executive to understand without getting lost in the weeds.
Exactly.
And they're so passionate about their expertise that sometimes all this jargon comes out because they're excited and they want it. But the executive's trying to get a high-level understanding of what to do next and gets lost in the weeds. So you make a really, really good point. I got to imagine, especially from the transition from being even a senior principal engineer to becoming a manager and then teaching other people along the way, that's got to be in some way, shape, or form a difficult transition as you start to interact more with other leaders of cross-functional teams.
It definitely is. It definitely is. And it's not even just communicating with your executives or your high-ups, because they kind of know the industry, they know the technology. But then you also have to talk to sales folks. You know, you have to talk to the marketing people. You have to talk to people who have their own jargon and they have their own ways of thinking. And you just have to make sure that you understand and are able to translate appropriately to, you know, those particular areas. Extremely important.
So we mentioned your interest very early on in technology and kind of how it led you down the path. You thought you were going to perhaps go to medical school, become a doctor. You realize, hey, I'm more apt with the physics piece and kind of the hardcore, you know, engineering. Did you always know that you wanted to lead people?
No, and I don't even, you know, so my leadership style is really more of hands-on. You know, and I really gravitate more towards early stage startup companies. So in early stage startup companies, you don't have a whole lot of people, that you're really leading. And so my leadership style is more of, you know, hey, we need to get this done. Hey, guys, let's get together and let's go ahead and get this done. And actually, you know, even though I wasn't all that good in sports, you know, I think that that's one of the things that I've learned in sports is, you know, being able to pull a team together and being able to, you know, work with a team as a team member and being able to lead a team. Even though I wasn't good, I was captain of the soccer team, you know, but being able to just pull people together and, you know, organize your goals and being able to go in that particular direction and have people follow you. I think that that's an important skill.
It's a huge skill because there's a lot of great, excellent contributors who want to be leaders, but they can't necessarily get people to follow because for one reason or another, one, they can't communicate that way, or two, they just can't build the rapport, they can't build the trust or the credibility or whatever. So anything else stand out to you? Because let's face it, even in early stage startup, you still have to be selected for that job, which means you have, during that interview process, you had to demonstrate some previous experience that was indicative that you could do it.
Yeah.
And what stands out to you about that piece?
Well, what stands out to me about that piece is it all builds, right? And it all is a matter of your network and the people that you meet along the way. You know, I'm not a big networker for the sake of networking, but what you want to be able to do is throughout your career, you want to be able to demonstrate, you know, success. You want to be able to demonstrate the fact that you're able to do things, and you want to be able to just meet people along the way and, you know, just be able to communicate, don't burn any bridges, make sure that you establish bridges throughout your career such that when you get to a particular point, somebody's recommending you for that particular job. And that's really what's happened through the majority of my career is once I got my foot into the door, it really was a matter of just moving through the process, having somebody say, hey, why don't we have this guy come in for this particular type of job? And then, you know, at a head start, you have a jump on a lot of other people that may be also looking at this particular job. So it's all really a matter of all of the people that you are interacting with along the way that will help you get into particular positions, especially if you're in a field that is relatively small. I mean, medical devices, okay, there's a lot of them, but actually relatively, it's a small community. And so what you want to do is you want to just make sure that you get your name out there, you meet a lot of people, you work with a lot of people. The last several positions that I've had really were associated with somebody I already worked with. you know, and I'm working with that particular person again. You also want to go through your career and be that person that other people want to work with. And I think that that's extremely powerful and extremely important.
I always say that by the time the job hits the job boards, a lot of times, especially at this level, half the recruiting is already done because the executive team knows people that are in the process, and then they're putting it out there either one for legal purposes or two, see what else can come up, or it doesn't even hit the boards because they're using a headhunter to go and dig into a network. That's a whole nother story. But yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I think the biggest takeaway from there is what a small world it really can be, and the importance of never burning a bridge. Not only showing up and delivering as much value as you can at any given time, but never burning a bridge.
Exactly. And the other important thing also is, you know, at that particular point, you can also control who you are working with as well. And that's really important in job satisfaction, because now you understand the people that, you know, are pulling you into that particular position, or that, you know, say, hey, you're good for that. You know whether or not you're going to want to work with them. You know whether or not you work well with them. And it's a matter of establishing that rapport within a team that is extremely, extremely important.
So look, we all have stress in our life. And I was just talking about this morning in our own morning meeting, how our job is, you know, for people not watching this on video, it, you know, it's a small piece of the entire pie of what makes up our life. And every facet of life presents its own opportunities, but its own stressors. And I got to imagine, I've never sat in the chair of a CTO, but I've got to imagine with timelines, with design, with development, with safety and all this stuff, you've got a lot of stress on your plate.
No, absolutely.
How do you manage it? How do you manage your stress?
Yeah, I mean, and that's depending on different people. You know, myself and my wife, we like to travel. And so we tend to, you know, schedule at least one trip. This year, we're doing two trips to different countries. And that gives us the time to kind of get away, to be able to put myself into a different kind of position, different kind of environment. And that's very refreshing. And I find it very refreshing for me. Being able to think in a different way and to learn in a different way. And you're using your brain in a different way, right? And that kind of, for me, at least me, it kind of resets me. The other thing is my wife and I also like the Atlanta Symphony, you know, so even though I was a bad musician early on, I like to listen to it at least, you know. And so, you know, we both enjoy, you know, going to the symphony on a regular basis. And then, you know, did watching sports and you know, kind of doing some other things outside of your direct, you know, roles and responsibilities outside of work. You know, trying to just get away for a little bit and just try to think in a different way.
So a couple of tag-on questions to that. I've said this on previous episodes myself, but one of my greatest challenges, well, with respect to this, is a couple of things. My kids are growing up fast and I want to be there and I want to enjoy the moments. And, you know, being at the park, there's been times I found myself, I'm pushing the swing and I'm texting about something for work. We're in the swimming pool and my head's somewhere else because something's going on at work. I have a very hard time. I'm there. I'm having those moments, but a lot of times my head is caught up in other things. How is it for you when you take these trips and stuff? Can you shut it off or do you work diligently? What do you do?
No, I mean, you do your best, you know, and within the trip, you know, there's times when you can shut it off. But what I typically do with the trips is I do take my laptop. I do take my phone. I have it available, but what I do is I just don't respond to things as quickly, and I will kind of schedule within my trip, you know, a time where I'm going to say, yeah, I'm going to catch up on things, make sure that there's no fires, there's, you know, nobody needs anything from me, and then I go back, you know, to the vacation. And so, you know, I think that, you know, you just can't always get away, but, you know, maybe you just take some time off and you just turn things off for a little while, but then, you know, schedule yourself to turn it back on.
That makes sense. And yeah, you're right. I like the idea of you're compartmentalizing to the best of your ability, basically. Like you're like, okay, I'm going to give myself this amount of time to check in with it. It gives me a sense of comfort that I know what's going on. And then I can go back to kind of focus on the fact that I'm on a trip.
Yeah. And not knowing also adds stress, right? And so I find that, you know, if I check in and things are okay, I'm going to enjoy myself. I'm going to enjoy the dinner that I'm going to have, you know, in another country or something, right?
Makes sense. Where are you going?
We just got back from Italy. And then in November, we're going to be going to New Zealand.
Oh, that's amazing. That is on my bucket list for sure. I've talked to some people on video who have their, you know, the countryside in their backyard or whatever it is. And I'm like, man, that's a gorgeous
place.
It is,
yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a place to unwind.
That's awesome. Jason, what would you say are the most acute challenges facing a CTO in 2024?
Yeah, and it's probably not just, you know, generic CTO. It's just in my shoes, I'm a medical device CTO.
Yeah, medtech CTO, sorry.
You know, because there's all kinds of industries where CTOs are defined all a whole bunch of different ways, right? And but in my particular industry, it's regulation. It's changing regulation and not consistent regulation. And it's nobody's fault, right? I mean, you have the FDA, you have regulators, you have a lot of different groups that are trying to understand technology. They're trying to generalize it as much as they can. And they're trying to structure it in such a way that it's not only fair, and they try to do it as least burdensome as possible. But at the same time, you know, you get to points where things are not all well defined. And you run into, you know, interpretation type of issues with a lot of the regulatory groups where they themselves don't really know what they want, you know, in a particular regulation. They just know they want it regulated, right? And so it's really trying to navigate and even define, you know, some of the new innovative technologies. You know, what is the regulation and what does the regulation actually mean? And with artificial intelligence, machine learning, you know, that's one of the particular things that, you know, regulatory agencies are really trying to, you know, establish. I mean, there's guidelines out there, there's guidance documents, and they're trying to get their heads around it. But the challenge is the fact that there's just so many applications that's going to go into, you know, handling it at a general level or even looking at it at only one level, you know, tends to paint yourself in a corner where, okay, some other applications, you know, those regulations are just completely meaningless and are completely blocking, you know, for another different type of application or another use of the technology. So it's a matter of trying to navigate through that whole process and just making sure that you understand how the regulators want to ensure that you're safe and effective, because the medical device company, we want to be safe and effective. You know, we just want to understand how we need to establish that fact.
And what a great segue. You know, the other topic I want to touch on with you is cybersecurity. You know, cybersecurity has always been of importance, always been a topic. Late in 2023, the FDA updated their guidance for cybersecurity. What's your take on it now, especially as it relates to Stratos Labs? Because the product has a machine learning algorithm that's connected to the cloud. I hear that FDA is, I don't know if it's true or what it is, but they're literally outsourcing the cybersecurity review to cybersecurity experts. And I don't know if organizations, everybody's kind of understanding that this is happening, but not necessarily, I don't know if they're realizing the importance of getting it right on the first time by the time they submit their application. What's your take on the cybersecurity element?
Well, you know, a few years ago, I think it was extremely challenging because there just was very little definition, you know, and very little agreement on definition. I think that the key is, you know, to establish agreement upon what definition is. You know, what is the definition of sufficient, you know, cybersecurity. And what's more promising is that there are different kinds of standards that are coming out that, you know, get a little bit closer to establishing, okay, well, here's what you need to do in order to demonstrate, you know, cybersecurity. You need to be able to have these series of controls in place and document the fact that you have these controls, document the fact that you tested them, and, you know, ensure that you are constantly monitoring these particular areas. So I think that the more that we can establish particular standards and have a little bit more definition around what, you know, cybersecurity means, the easier it is going to be for people to actually comply with all of those standards. You know, several years ago, the standards were all very, very high level, and it's left to interpretation of what some of those things mean. And the regulatory bodies end up interpreting one way, you interpret it the other way, and the regulatory bodies always win, right? So you end up having to do redesign. And so that's, I think, extremely important, is to, you know, establish a lot more definition around, you know, what it means to be secure.
And I can only imagine just the snowball effect of all this with all the legacy devices out there and what it means in the hospital world and some of the updates that are going to have to be caught up to speed in a very quick fashion, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, you need some level of grandfathering or some level of, you know, establishing a appropriate period of time where you meet these things. And typically that's done, but everybody's always surprised in the end when things switch over.
Or it could just be like EU MDR where there's a deadline and then all of a sudden the deadline's non-existent. And then there's another deadline and the deadline's pushed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those types of things, you know, consistency and lack of definition are the main challenges. And, you know, and it actually ends up punishing companies that, you know, are really diligent in trying to meet these standards. Because if you change the date of a standard and the company spent a lot of money, and cybersecurity is a very, very expensive. If you spend a lot of money up front and then all of a sudden, oh, well, we didn't have to do that. Okay, well, now that's opportunity cost associated with all the money that you put into it. So, you know, versus a company that didn't put the money into it, okay, well, they use their money for something else.
Right, right. It's a really good point that I didn't even think about. It makes a lot of sense. You know, we've talked a few different angles here. A lot of it has been your background, your career. I want to give you an opportunity. Is there anybody who's been a former boss, current boss for that matter, a mentor in your world, who you think has been either had a significant impact in one way, shape, or form, or instrumental in kind of propelling your career?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of different people along the way, you know, and, you know, usually you have mentors and you have various people that, you know, come in and out of your life that affect it. I think there were two primary people that I can think of off the top of my head, you know, Dr. Charles Seisler. He was the one that worked with me on the product that my very first entry into engineering with the glasses. Dr. Jay Yadov, he was the founder of CardioMEMS. And that really gave me, and through his guidance and his mentorship, I was able to, you know, really develop my leadership skills and acumen.
Awesome. And earlier you mentioned, hey, you know, I'm a hands-on leader. My forte is working in early stage startups. It's an all hands on deck approach. I look at this as a collaboration. Yes, but you're also in charge and you're the guy that they're following. And so you've managed R&D, you've managed engineering, you've seen top performance, you've seen not so great performance. I want to talk about the individual contributor level for a minute. What do you think really does, let's take engineering for example. What do you think does separate great engineers from average?
Yeah, I think the great engineers are, you know, they're constantly trying to accomplish the goal, okay? They are constantly defining what the problem is. You know, one of the things that I try to impart to, you know, some of our engineers is to really establish what the problem is, understand what the problem is, and then think about the solutions. You know, so some of the engineers that I consider are really good are the ones that really define what the problem is up front and come up with a solution based off of that really defined problem versus, you know, maybe somebody that's very knowledgeable, but probably is not as good of an engineer. What they'll do is they'll just start throwing out solutions just because they know what the solution actually is, but not really understanding what the problem that they're trying to solve. And yeah, that's a credible solution, but it's not the right one for this particular problem, you know? And so I think the key to being a really good individual contributor is, you know, defining the problem that you're trying to solve.
So in essence, slowing down to speed up.
It's not necessarily slowing down, but it's working smart versus working fast and hard, you know? And so you don't start with a solution, you start with the definition of the problem.
Mm-hmm. So I want you to clarify that a little bit, because I'm sitting here thinking, well, yeah, how could you throw out a solution if you have no idea what you're trying to solve? Can you give an example? I mean, you don't necessarily need to have a concrete example, but when you say they throw out solutions because they know, they think they know the answer, they have to have some sort of context though, right? Of what they think they're solving. So that's what I was wondering, like when you say really define the problem.
Yeah, I mean, there's details. And you know, whenever you're doing any design or development, there's usually a lot of different ways that you can solve a particular solution. And also, there's a lot of different tools that you can use to solve a particular solution. You know, I'm struggling to find a particular example off the top of my head. But, you know, there's what you typically want to do is just make sure that, you know, and part of it, you know, that I see a lot is, you know, defining the right tool to actually use for the particular job that you want to solve. you know, and okay. So one example is that, you know, a lot of engineers will have their favorite, you know, development tool, or they'll have their favorite, you know, methodology of completing a particular task. Well, they'll choose to do it that way, which is one way of doing it. But in the end, it may take you a lot longer to do it that way than to just solve the problem, you know, with using something, you know, less simple. It's just essentially, you know, picking the right tool for the right job and just making sure, sure. that you're doing it accurately. And that's all part of the process, right? You know, there's a lot of aspects of solving an individual problem. You know, one is to, you know, really understand the problem. And then two is to, you know, okay, during the solution that you're leading, whatever you're doing to lead to that solution, you are using the appropriate methodology to get there. And
yep.
again, you know,
okay.
And I'm guilty of this too. You know, you want to get to the solution as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
But you need to sometimes yep. just step back and say, okay, well, let me think for this for a second. And, you yep. know, we think.
And that's the piece that you're talking about, working smarter.
Exactly.
It's having exactly. the patience to kind of sit in it for a minute versus it's like, okay, hold on a minute. Let's be diligent and really think this through.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and yeah. one of the things, one of the methodologies that you do is you put together requirement specifications. And one of the things that I typically find routinely over and over again is if you don't sit down and put the requirement specifications together properly, you end up missing something. And one of the things that you find is, okay, well, when you miss something and you don't have it in your requirement specification, you don't test for it. And if you don't test for it, it doesn't happen. And then when you get into validation, all of a sudden, that requirement doesn't work. You know, that particular way of working doesn't work. And what ends up happening is when you find it at the end, it may take you 3 or 4 more times the actual man hours to actually fix the problem versus establishing what the problem was in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, and
makes
so
a lot of
that's
sense.
Why
Thank
I say
you.
It's not necessarily, you know, slow down. What it is really, you know, work smart so that you're not fixing problems later. You
yep.
have established the correct, you know, chain of solutions. You systematically solve the problem.
That makes a whole bunch of sense. There literally is a garbage truck driving by right now. Can you hear that in the background?
I can't, but can you hear somebody
okay,
mowing
good.
Here?
Oh, as long as you can.
Okay. No, I can't hear yours.
We're going to keep on trucking. So those who are aspiring to be a CTO one day, or they're a director of engineering right now, or perhaps, you know, they're in R&D and they're like, okay, you know, I'm an engineer by trade. One day I'm going to be a CTO, whatever it may be. If you look back over all these years, what advice would you share?
Yeah. And so, and this is what I tell everybody that reports to me, you know, in our, you know, reviews is, you know, take a look at what your job description is now and take a look at what the job description that is for the person that you want to become, you know, and start doing the things that is in their job description, you know, because I hear sometimes, you know, somebody says, oh, that's not in my job description, or that's above my pay grade. You know, you hear those kinds of things, and that's actually okay, but that's not a person that's looking to be promoted. That's not a person that's looking to advance their career. What you want to be able to do is, and it's been very successful for me, is you just start doing the things that are at the next job level, right? And people are not typically going to tell you not to do that, right? Because all this stuff has to get done. And then all of a sudden, you're going to see as you're starting to do those kinds of things that you are incrementally becoming that individual person over time. So like I said, I would always go and look at the next job description that you want to go into and start doing that. And as I get, you know, a higher level in my career, I'm actually looking for people to replace me. I'm looking for people who want to be able to take on some of my responsibilities so that I can move on to something else. And so, you know, the more successful people will come and start doing some of the things that I'm responsible for. I'll move my focus over to something else that needs my attention a little bit more, and they become in charge of that particular area, or they move forward in their career in that particular area. And it's an organic process. It's not overnight, and you have to do a lot of work, but I think it's actually a process that would work very successfully for me, because in doing that, you also find out, okay, well, I may not be all that good at it. I may not want that particular position. And therefore, you know, you don't accept a promotion into that position if you start, you know, trying it and you're not good at it. So I think that that's a good way of approaching it, is just to start looking and trying to accomplish some of the roles and take on some of the roles and responsibilities of what is above your pay grade.
That is some of the best advice that I've heard out of all the times I've asked that question. And it's funny, because when I interview candidates who are directors and they say, I report to a VP, I say, what does your VP do that you don't do? And, you know, sometimes they'll rattle off. It's like, okay, well, there's the gap, right? What? That's the gap of what you need to learn.
Exactly.
Now, I would add on to what you said, which is making it known that eventually I want to be this, and start asking, because people want a mentor, especially, look, the signs of a great leader are being able to replace themselves or develop a team that goes off and flies on their own, because the leader gets satisfaction that they help build that person.
Absolutely.
And so a leader who is a servant leader who wants to see their team grow and flourish is going to want to help you, but they can't necessarily help you if you're not voicing what your aspirations are. And so I think it's twofold. I think it's one, standing up and being vocal about it. And I think also being proactive, like you said, that the people who are like, oh, that's not part of my job. So, well, one, is that not, you're not really being a team player. Two, how motivated do you think somebody is going to be to help advocate and promote you if you're not willing to get outside of your box and really contribute and try and stretch yourself? So, man, I love that advice. It's the first time I've heard somebody that I've interviewed say that. So thank you. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, and as the leader, you know, you have so many balls in the air, you actually would welcome somebody to take one of those balls, you know? And so I welcome somebody to come in and say, hey, you know, can I take that from you?
That's awesome. All right, Jason, we're going to fast forward, man. We're at your retirement party. Everybody's there to celebrate you. And it comes time for speeches. What are you hoping they would say?
Well, I just hope that they say that, you know, they enjoyed working with me. You know, we had a good time developing some very successful products. And, you know, I hope that they say that I've made a difference in, you know, what their work environment has been and what their career has evolved to. And, you know, I hope that I can leave things better than when I came in.
Right on. Well, listen, you've dropped some great, great nuggets today. I can't thank you enough for being a valued guest on the show. If it's okay with you, what we're going to do is put a link in the show notes to your LinkedIn profile, as well as a link to Stratos Labs. I want to leave it with you. Is there anything in particular about what's going on with the company that you'd like the MedTech audience to know?
Well, I mean, we're just extremely busy. We're extremely active in providing our device to the pharmaceutical market. We have multiple customers all over the world that are doing clinical studies with our device. So we're really excited at the point that we're at. And we're really excited about the data that we're being able to provide to researchers and pharmaceutical companies.
Awesome. Well, we wish you guys continued success. Again, thank you for being here, and looking forward to a bright rest of your future career as well.
Thanks, Mitch. It's great talking to you.
Thanks for listening to the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. For more content-rich episodes, log on to theanthonymichaelgroup.com or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform.